Okay, then, would you like to turn to Luke 22? Luke chapter 22. We are at what we tend to call the Last Supper. And we've seen how that differed from all the other Passover meals there'd ever been. And we've also seen that Judas left to do his thing before they shared in the bread and the wine. And we've seen how, even at this point in time, they were still arguing, the disciples were still arguing over who should be the greatest. Now the attention turns to Peter as Jesus addresses him personally, because Jesus knows that he's going to deny him. And of course the question is, did Peter's faith fail? And the answer is no. He still believed in the Lord, even though he ended up denying him. Nor did his love fail. So what was it then that failed? Well, quite simply, it was his hope. It was his hope. You see, because when he saw Jesus being led away in ropes and being brought to Caiaphas, his hope was gone. And you know, maybe you're in Peter's sandals today, because you know, you believe in the Lord and you have a definite love for the Lord, but your hope has been diminished because you can't figure out how what's happening to you could possibly work for good. And I was thinking about this, and I remember a story I heard quite some time ago now, because there was a group of scientists and a study was done on Norwegian wharf rats. Now, I've got no idea what a Norwegian wharf rat even looks like. But the story goes that after being thrown into the open water, because these things were just taking over and they were a real pest. So after being thrown into open water, one group of these rats paddled about for about 3.5 minutes before drowning. The second group was thrown in, but they were plucked out just before they drowned. The next day, when those rats were thrown back into the water, the scientists were astounded to find them able to tread water for 45 minutes or more, because evidently they were hoping they would be rescued, just as they were the previous day. And the same is true with us, because if we don't have hope that we'll be rescued, we sink. But if we have that hope that a rescue is coming, we can tread water through all sorts of hard times. And I don't think it's coincidental at all that the rapture of the church in Titus 2:13 is called the blessed hope. Because although sometimes we might feel like we're in a rat race and going under quickly, we also know that today could be the day of the Lord's return. So I think as we look at Peter this morning, hope is the key here. Hope is the key, because as he looks at Jesus being carried away, he's lost all hope. So let's start today at verse 31 in chapter 22 of Luke. Luke 22, verse 31, which says this. It says, "And the Lord said to Simon," or said rather, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, that your faith fail not. And when you are converted, strengthen your brethren." And he said to him, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you both into prison and to death." And he said, "I tell you, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that you shall thrice deny that you know me." Interesting few verses, aren't they? The first thing is, when Jesus says your name twice, you kind of know that you're in trouble, right? And then the other thing about this is that it's only in Luke that we get this thing about Satan sifting and Jesus praying for Peter. So it's an interesting insight, a really interesting insight. Listen, in Luke's gospel, as he writes this, I believe that at this moment in time, Paul was probably in Caesarea for 2 years while Luke was garnering information from witnesses. And here, we kind of see Luke pulling back the veil a little bit on this particular evening as he writes his gospel. And I think what that does is it allows us to see what's happening in this dark and spiritual world that we live in. And I think this is really important, so important. So listen up. Genuine faith never refuses to discern the amount of light that the Lord gives to us about this world that we live in. And the world that we live in that world, there's all kinds of insanity out there. From UFOs and our space brothers are coming and all that stuff, which is all deception, of course. And then we have the psychic hotline, which you can call, and tarot cards and astrology. And there's all kinds of strange and supposedly wonderful things out there that the world is taking in and getting caught up with. And then sadly, there's enough of it that it gets into the church, to where warfare and the enemy is sensationalized, where there are people in the church that give Satan more print than the Bible gives him. And then there's what's known as spiritual mapping and all this stuff that goes on. None of that's biblical, but there is an enemy and there is spiritual warfare. And the world is going to think you're insane if you believe in that and accept that. And it isn't justified and it's not fair. I mean, we believe that there are voices all around us on the airwaves. And if you turn on your iPhone, you can hear them. Don't do that right now, of course, but, you know. And we believe that there are images all around us as well. And if you turn on your iPhone, you could get those as well. And we believe in those things because we understand transmission and reception. But the Bible tells us, no, there are other voices and there are other images. And the reality is that there's another realm. And somehow, if you go to Oxford or Cambridge and you study parapsychology, you're a genius. But if you're a Christian and you believe in spiritual realms, you're an idiot. And it's not fair, because we know the truth. So when Jesus pulls back the curtain a bit and he says, Simon, Simon, Satan has desired, he's requested, he's asked permission. And what he wants of you is going to be a sifting process in your life. But knowing all those things ahead of time, before you're aware of them, Peter, and that I've prayed for them, your faith is not going to fail. And when you're restored, not if, but when, I want you to strengthen your brothers. So this is a remarkable passage that we have in front of us this morning. But we don't want to give the enemy more press than he deserves. And the best thing that we can remember as we look at this is that our dad can beat their dad any day. I mean, we used to say things like that when we were kids. Well, that's the way it is with God, our Father. Because he is the victorious antagonist, if you like, of the devil. Those are big words, I know. But there is activity. And there are things happening, and there is another realm. And we are surrounded every day of our lives with a battle of ideas and concepts and morals. James tells us that the tongue itself is set on fire of Gehenna, because the tongue is what promotes bigotry and war and hatred and homosexuality and abortion. Anything that rubs you up the wrong way as a Christian, all that is promoted by the tongue. And James says that the enemy is wise enough to understand that. And now, of course, with social networking, the most powerful force on the planet right now, talking about human power, that is, it even has overturned governments. And that's how this stuff spreads. There is a spiritual realm, and there is warfare between truth and error and light and darkness. And it works in the areas of ideas, morality and truth. So we need to keep our feet on a firm foundation, the Word of God, because this is what the Scriptures say morality is. You know, this is what it says from the point of view of a creator. There is no evolution. This is what, you know, the Word says about morality. This is what it says about drugs, what it says about alcohol, what it says about greed, what it says about gossip. But the world is going to tell you something completely different. There are, however, greater forces than those in London and Washington and Moscow and all the power centres of this world. Because behind the scenes, yeah, there are great forces at work, but behind the scenes there is the greatest force at work, Jesus Christ. And he said, "The Father has given all authority and power unto me." He told us that before he ascended. So look, we have this picture here, and it's in the context of the Passover evening. And we need to understand this, because verse 24 tells us that there's this big argument going on, and they're arguing over who's going to be the greatest. Jesus corrects that, and he says, "Look, I've got to give it to you guys. You've stuck with me during my temptations, and there's going to be a place for you in the kingdom." And he corrects all of their thinking. But I get the sense that Peter's voice was one of the loudest in that argument, to the point where Jesus looks at him and he says to him now, "Simon, Simon." And then he says, "Satan has desired to sift you." And it's interesting because that word "you" there is plural. So he's actually now talking to all of them. So what appears to happen is this. It's after he settles down this argument and got everybody calmed down, Peter, being one of the firebrands in that melee, he turns to Peter, he says, "Simon, Simon." And then he turns to all the guys and says, "Satan has desired to sift you all as wheat." And in the other Gospels he said, "Strike down the shepherd and the sheep will all be scattered." Because he knows what's going to happen to all these guys. Here he says, "Satan's going to sift you all as wheat." And then he goes back to the singular, talking to Peter, because he knows Peter's going to be a particular target. And he says, "I prayed for you, singular Peter." He says to him, "But I prayed for you, singular, that your singular faith fail not. And when you, singular, are converted, strengthen your singular brethren." So he turns back to Peter specifically. But in looking at this, it shows us that warfare is involved in everybody's life. So Jesus kind of gives us its insight here, and it's so important. And what we see here is this. The enemy had come in this scene, and the enemy, he says here, desired. He's asked permission. Some say that it should be translated, he's begged permission. And it's the picture, a picture of the enemy on a lead. Because he doesn't have freedom to touch any of us on his own. And that's great news. It tells us elsewhere that the enemy comes and he touches us not. And that we're washed in the blood of Jesus and he has nothing in us. And it says that you and I are sealed with the Spirit of promise. And that's interesting because that word "sealed" there is the same word that's used in Revelation chapter 20. When Satan is cast into the abyss. And it says there that he's sealed for 1,000 years. And if he can't break that seal, he certainly can't break the one that's on us, right? Now, does that mean that we don't experience warfare? Of course not. Of course not. And you know, people say, I got a flat tire, you know, and the devil was... No. It might have been a nail. Now, does that mean that the devil doesn't come and say, "Well, if he really loved you, how come your tire went down?" Or you might say, oh, I was almost past the McDonald's drive-through and a car just turned in there by itself. That's not warfare. You eat hamburgers, you should control yourself. Look, the warfare here is directed at Peter's faith. And warfare today is directed at your relationship with Jesus Christ. Warfare today is directed at your relationship with Jesus Christ. And God knows that, and you need to know that too. And if you spend too much time out there in the world today, you are going to struggle. You're going to struggle. Problem is, you see, that's where most of us spend our time. Whether it's work in the commercial world or socialising in the world at large. And if you spend any more time than you absolutely have to out there in the world, you are going to struggle. Why do you think we put on home groups and Bible studies and lifestyle and prayer meetings during the week? Why do you think we do that? It's because you will have a terrible struggle surviving if you're trying to get by on just a Sunday to Sunday basis. That's what those things are there for. And what we're allowed to peer into in our passage this morning is the fact that the devil comes and he asks permission. And we see that very thing happen in Job chapter 1, don't we? The oldest book in the Bible. I mean, you know that story. God says there to the devil about Job, well, you can test him, but you can't touch him. Now, thinking about that, if God said that to you about somebody, what would you do? Put a beautiful girl in front of them, or a tall, dark, handsome man in front of them? Get somebody to give them more change than they should get? What would you do to test somebody? I mean, with Job, Satan kills all of his children, burns down his home, destroys all of his herds, all of his flocks, all of his crops. He dismantles his entire life and leaves his wife alive next to him, saying, curse God and die, curse God and die, because she can't stand the pressure. She's saying, all your children were just ripped away from you. You see, Satan is limited in power, but he is boundless in malice. I'll say it again, he's limited in power, but he is boundless in malice. He's insane. He's a really sore loser. But he can't do anything in our lives except by permission. And the interesting thing here that we see is that he's restrained. He's on God's leash. And it's only by permission that this sifting is going to take place. Now look, you see, they all understood what sifting was. They understood what it was all about because it was part of the culture that they were in. When the grain was harvested, it was cut off at the top of the stalks and it was thrown onto the threshing floor. And then the threshing sled or sledge was dragged over the top of it. That was called the tribulum. We've been through this before, but the tribulum, the tribulation in English. That was dragged over the top of it. And that would separate the top of the stalk from the wheat. After that took place for a while, then it was winnowed. The wind would come up in the evenings on the top of the hill where the threshing floor was, and they would take the straw and they would throw handfuls of it up in the air, and the grain would fall to the ground and the straw would blow away. And then the last thing to take place was the sifting, which separated the wheat from the chaff. And it was a process of separating that which was valuable from that which was not valuable. Separating the wheat from the chaff. Separating that which was good from that which was to be cast aside and burned. And Jesus said to his disciples, Satan's desired to sift you as wheat. Now, I don't think personally that the enemy's idea is to sift them like wheat. Jesus says he's going to sift you like wheat is sifted. It's going to be in that manner because, I mean, the enemy didn't want the chaff to blow away and have the wheat left because the enemy always wants to prove that you aren't anything but chaff. The enemy, you see, he didn't know that by the time he's done with Peter, he's going to be stronger than he's ever been, or he'd have never done it. So Jesus allows it. And, you know, he doesn't say, I pray that you escape the trial, does he? That's not what he prayed. And he doesn't say, I pray that you don't fail, because Peter did fail. He says, Peter, I prayed that your faith doesn't fail. And it didn't. I mean, you watch him in Gethsemane. He's asleep. He wakes up. He hacks somebody's ear off. And by the end of the night, he's got some little maid saying, I know you. You're one of the disciples. He's going, ah. And finally, but by the third time, he says, let me be damned if I know who he is. And the rooster goes, cock-a-doodle-doo. And Jesus turns and it says their eyes meet. And Peter sees the look of Jesus, which wasn't, you know, ha, you've blown it, pal. You know, Jesus didn't look at him and go. Jesus looks at him here and he says, now, Peter, you're going to crumble, but your faith is not going to fail. And when you're restored, you're going to encourage your brethren. And in verses 33 and 34 say, and he said to him, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both into prison and to death. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that you shall thrice deny that you know me. Because at this moment in time, you know, Peter was so cocksure of himself that he was crowing about how reliable he was, you know. Now, verse 35 says, and he said to them, this is Jesus saying now to the disciples, when I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, did you lack anything? And they said, nothing. Then he said to them, but now, he that has a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you, that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me. And he was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. Now again, this is not what it appears to be on the surface, because you see, when Jesus told the disciples to go buy a sword, he was using an idiom. He wasn't going, you know, go buy a sword and, you know, start using it. You know, what he's saying, it was similar to our saying, keep your powder dry. In other words, he was telling them that the climate was changing from the days previously when they were with him and they were embraced and provided for in ministry. Because back in Matthew 10, if you remember, he sent them out there and he told them then, behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils and they will scourge you in their synagogues. And you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. And at this point in time, those days were about to come to fruition. Verse 39 says, and he came out and went, as he was wont, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. So, after celebrating the Passover, and after speaking very pointedly to all of his disciples, and after speaking to Peter, and after warning his disciples that the times would be changing, Jesus leaves the city and he crosses the little riverbed at the bottom of the Kidron Valley, and he comes to the Mount of Olives. You know, the word Kidron means dark or murky, and it was given that name because the blood of the sacrifices would drain out of the temple and run down into this brook below. So because of that, only hours before his death, Jesus will be stepping over a brook that ran blood red. And when he gets to Gethsemane, there's a cup that he's going to embrace. Remember in Matthew's Gospel, It says there that when the disciples were arguing over who was going to be the greatest, he said to them, "Are you ready to drink the cup that I must drink and be baptized with the baptism that I must be baptized with?" And we're going to see that he's going to pray over this particular cup three times as we move into these scenes. Luke, of course, is the physician. And he's going to be the one to tell us, because he's a doctor, he says that he sweats drops of blood, hematidrosis. And that happens when the emotional agony is so intense that the capillaries in your sweat glands actually burst and the blood runs out with your sweat. It's a physical phenomenon that's been recorded by doctors, hematidrosis. And Luke's going to tell us that an angel has to come to strengthen him, so that he could continue to agonize. And he's agonizing over a cup. And you know, as we look at that in scripture, again, it's not a literal cup. He wouldn't be worried over just a cup. But we find that term used in scripture a lot, such as the cup of God's blessing, for instance. It says, "You anoint my head with oil, my cup runneth over." The cup of God's blessing, spoken of many times in the Old Testament. And there's also the cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's fury, if you like. And there's the cup of the wine of his indignation as well. And that term is used at least 15 times in the Old Testament. So there's this cup as he comes to Gethsemane. And it wasn't just the physical brutality ahead of him that he's going to agonize over. It's the sin of the world, the sin of the whole world. He who knew no sin became sin, that we might be the very righteousness of God. So he comes to the place where the wrath of God is actually satisfied. You see, and I think we've talked about this before, but it's always the person that's sinned against that determines the seriousness of the grievance, isn't it? Because, you know, if you experience a domestic dispute, no, you won't, but the police might come and they might lock you up for fighting with your wife or your husband. Don't do that. But if you commit a crime against a police officer, for instance, it's looked upon as being a bit more serious. Or it could even be a more serious crime than that. I mean, if it's against the Prime Minister, it could be treason. You could be locked up for life. You see, it's all dependent upon whom you commit the crime against. And it's good that we know this, you know, because when the sin is committed against a pure, almighty, holy, everlasting, omniscient, omnipotent God, then the seriousness of that crime is determined by the one who sinned against. And the price that has to be paid then is infinite, and more than we could ever pay. And it's that cup that all the nations of the world that don't turn to Christ will drink of. And that's the cup that he's going to agonize over. So he goes out to the Mount of Olives now, and the disciples follow him. And we're going to pick it up from there next time. Let's bow our hearts to pray.